This week on Fax Machine, we learn why a clean shave might save you beer money, how soda was conceived by impregnating water, and Noah gets ambitions to break a sausage-making world record. Welcome to Fax Machine. Welcome to this week's episode of Fax Machine. I'm Emily Costa, and I'm here with my co-host Noah Guyberson.
Hello.
And Rob Frawley.
Hey there.
And as you might have noticed, we're sounding exceptionally dulcet-toned today, thanks to some swanky new audio equipment and an even swankier new producer who's running it. You know him as the composer of Fax Machine's badass face-melting intro theme. It's Anthony Antonelli.
Woo! Hey!
You can't see, but he's waving right now.
What's that, Anthony? Speak up.
I'm not ready to be a part of this.
Sorry, I just got to ease your way in. Since this episode is coming to you on the heels of St. Paddy's Day, this week we're talking about Guinness. Now, for some of you, it's probably a lovely day for a Guinness, but for those of you who are still feeling a little green from the weekend's festivities, I implore you to grab some Pepto and stick it out with us. Between this week's exchange of fascinating facts and our signature pub-style trivia quiz, loosely inspired by the theme, of course, we've got some pretty awesome stuff brewing. So, without further ado, Rob, what have you got for us?
This week I learned that the man who invented the nitro beer, which gives Guinness its signature flavor and texture, had never brewed a beer in his life and was actually a professional trained mathematician.
Whoa.
Interesting.
Yeah. So a little career change at some point in his life. It's not too late for you guys.
Noted.
This is the interesting story of a man named Michael Ashe. So Michael Ashe was born in Calcutta, 1927. He moved back to the British Isles, where he then attended Trinity College, Cambridge, and was a top scholar. He went on to teach and stay in academia for a little while until 1948, when he was hired by Guinness for no particular reason, except that he was very smart. And Guinness knew they needed smart people to try to refine their brewing process and kind of increase efficiency in the factory. And so what they asked him to do initially is not what he's famous for, to the degree that he's famous at all. He actually was brought in because they wanted to try to increase the shelf life of beer. And so his first project, right out of, you know, his math program, was, hey, I had a couple months of this beer. That was what he worked on for a little bit. But his true passion was trying to fix this problem about how Guinness used to be poured. So Guinness is, even today, a very complex beer to pour. And if you've had a Guinness, you've seen the artisan, like, craftfulness that goes into making the perfect Guinness. It was much harder before the 1950s, because what you needed to do, you actually needed two separate casks. And this is called the draft problem. That one cask was the high cask, or the beer that was made to go on top, and the rest of it was the low cask. And that was all the remaining beer that filled the glass. And they had different textures and weights, in fact, and they would sit atop each other in such a way that made the perfect creamy Guinness. But this was not only difficult to pour, and it took time for bartenders and publicans to actually do, but it required you shipping two separate casks of beer and having the right ratios in them and then use them properly. And so it was not cost effective, and it really irked Ashe. He really wanted to make this happen. And so he set about fixing it. And in the way that only a true nerd can do, he identified that one of the problems was the gas that they were using in the beer. So instead of carbonating beer with carbon or carbon dioxide, like most pop drinks, most beers are, he turned to nitrogen. So he saw nitrogen as the answer, and he put it quite clearly. He said, quote, "It's such an obvious gas." Like any idiot could see. But he liked it for it was inert. It was something that was in the atmosphere. It's 80% of what we breathe. And so he really believed, like, oh, this is the perfect thing to put into our beer. It has the properties we want. It's going to make this beer behave in the cask the way that we want it to. The only problem was it would require a completely different type of keg. So once he had figured out the chemical issue of putting nitrogen into beer, then he had to figure out how to dispense that beer from a single cask. So he worked for a long time with Guinness cask makers. And Guinness was about 190 years old when he tried to completely change the way that they kegged and bottled and shipped their beer.
So there was a lot of opposition, I bet.
Yeah, it was you know how things are. Like, it takes a little bit of evidence to show that something should be changed. So this was not widely received in the Guinness factory as a great idea. So people looked at him and his newfangled kegs and his crazy chemistry experiments, and they came up with a few different nicknames for his project. One of them they called Daft Guinness. But the other one...
Like draft, but dumb.
Yeah. But the other one that's really good is they called his keg the Ash Can.
Okay, that's actually good.
That's so good.
That's quite good.
I mean, I think he's definitely the protagonist of this story, but that was like a solid burn.
Yeah. Whoever came with that one, well done. Yeah. But so eventually he did work on this problem and managed to get a keg that could dispense beer in two different ways. So one that would pour what was traditionally the low cask beer into the body of the glass. And then you could switch the dispenser on the cask and pour out the high cask beer that would form the head. This is still essentially the same keg that we use today in bars to serve Guinness. And so it took him about 10 years to really get this process working and to show some prototypes to Guinness that they were satisfied with and they liked the flavor and they actually liked how efficient and cost-saving it was. And they finally launched the keg in 1959, but the last couple of years of this project, they really pushed him to be able to produce and mass produce these kinds of kegs because 1959 was the 200th anniversary of Guinness.
Right, okay.
And so as part of their bicentennial, they were trying to rebrand this new delivery mechanism for the beer so that everyone could enjoy the perfect pour of Guinness much more easily.
That always goes really well if you recall New Coke.
Oh, yeah. Like the exact same. Like we're all still drinking New Coke, right?
But we are still all drinking New Guinness.
Yeah, which is the amazing thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
like, this could have gone horribly, horribly wrong. Like, this could have been just, you know, think of the worst, like, micro-brewed beer you've ever had. This could have been Guinness. But instead, it became like this hallmark. And so the reason was, even though a lot of people did actually object initially to the new flavor of Guinness, they said that the nitrogen kind of stifles the flavor, the aroma was lost, like, the entire drinking experience changed. A lot of people liked it. A lot of people, especially to whom the beer was exported, really enjoyed it. And so overseas sales of Guinness really went up right after the 200th birthday. And this was all because Ash had made this very stable keg that could be sent distances and dispensed all at once so that any dumb American could pour the right perfect Guinness.
There's a great story about Barack Obama, who on a later trip to Ireland talked about a previous trip that was, I think, top secret at the time, where his Air Force One was on the way to Afghanistan and they stopped down in Shannon and had enough time to like get a beer. Having had Guinness in the States, he said that his Guinness in Ireland was much better. Now, he might have just been pandering, but I just feel like he wouldn't lie to us.
But what would his motives be? It's just a good Guinness.
He's pandering to the Irish electorate.
Why?
Well, because there are more Irish people in the United States than in all of Ireland.
Oh, I was kidding. That's a really good point.
Yeah.
That is a good point. Okay, there we go.
And asked the Irish, and we never forget.
Rob's Irish. Yeah. You should clarify.
Even though I sounded like the Swedish chef.
Please don't write in.
Nope.
Speaking of other people who have famous associations with Guinness, there's a guy I've been trying to bring up on the podcast for a while, and it's the Irish writer and playwright Brendan Behan. And he has a couple really excellent plays, one pretty famous novel. But the story about him in particular that I want to tell comes from his first really well-received play. That's The Quair Fellow. It had opened to great reviews in Ireland. A couple years had passed, I think. And then it was finally ready to open in the West End in London. So like the Broadway of London. And so he was doing a promotional appearance on a TV show. And this appearance ended up generating a ton of publicity for the show. And people got really, really excited about it. And this was kind of weird to have a lot of British people, particularly English people, really excited about this guy. Because his background was, you know, he was born into like an Irish Republican family. He had actually joined the IRA as a teenager. So it's not exactly the kind of person you would expect for English people to like really fall in love with, but they fell in love with him because of his behavior on that television show. And basically he was just really, really hammered on Guinness. For some reason they just absolutely fell in love with him. And there was actually another person on that show at the time, the Irish American comedian, you guys know Jackie Gleason.
Oh yeah, sure.
Yeah.
The Honeymooners.
Who at the time described his newfound popularity in London as, quote, not an act of God, but as an act of Guinness. which I thought was pretty funny. But he has a couple other stories about him that him throughout his life being closely associated with Guinness. And that is one of the best ones is that Guinness was looking for a new like ad campaign. And he was a very famous, celebrated Irish author. And so they went to him and they commissioned him to write a slogan for them. And his terms were that they would have to give him a, I think it was like a crate of Guinness or a case of Guinness, some large quantity of Guinness every single week that he was working on this new slogan. And then like he would come back to them and give them what he had. But he needed to drink the beer to like get in the Guinness mood or whatever.
Spirit.
Yeah, perhaps. Spirit. Nice. But some time passed, a couple weeks. They kept sending him the beer. They were getting no slogan in return. And finally, apparently, some Guinness representatives come by his apartment and they go in and there's just like Guinness bottles everywhere and just like balled up paper like around the, you know, wastebasket everywhere. He's just like lying on the ground. And then they were like, well, where's our slogan? And then he gets up, like unfolds one of the pieces of paper and it just says, Guinness, it gets you drunk.
I've got to say, I feel like that's a perverse incentive system where it's like, here's something that clearly doesn't improve productivity and we'll give it to you every week until you finish.
Well, I mean, arguably, that's a great slogan. It's, I mean, the thesis statement is right there.
Yeah. Mm. It does not mince words, for sure. So speaking of populations of people for whom the drinking of Guinness might be an unusual experience, seeing as how I'm recording this in a room full of bearded fellows, which you can't see, but you can just take my word for it, I looked into a study that was covered in some articles from 2000 in both The Guardian and BBC about some research commissioned by Guinness to sort of see what the drinking experience was like for bearded Guinness drinkers.
Nice.
So per Guinness's calculations, roughly 162,719 pints of their signature drink are lost every year in the UK due to the imbibers' mustaches, or generally facial hair, but stashes are just more fun to say.
I'd say pour some out, but that just compounds the problem.
Exactly. Pour some out directly into your facial hair. So,
I mean, I'm not going to pretend like I haven't poured beer in my face.
Is it because it's kind of like a Gatorade in a barrel kind of scenario of just like...
Of just
drenching yourself in celebration?
Victorious Guinness? No.
Okay.
Just, you know, stray beer.
All right, that's fair.
No, I'm just saying I'm very familiar with this concept.
Yeah, and I'm super grateful that someone actually took the time to study this because it's the kind of thing that like can ruin your 3 seconds of your life as you have just like a big foamy mustache.
Well, and then so the crazy thing about it
looks
is that
at you and you're like,
what are you saying?
I'm just saying that you get really self-conscious about it.
Well, I didn't see anything about that issue specifically in the results of this study. But I will say that it does get surprisingly granular in terms of breaking down the sort of specific volume loss and also loss of cost that basically disappears in someone's facial hair. So the average mustachioed Guinness drinker loses 1.5 pints of Guinness to their stash every year. And that breaks down to an annual beard tax of 4.5 pounds.
Wow.
So in other words, the summation of money that you pay on beer, 4.5 pounds of that in the UK gets lost to your beard.
I wonder if they break it down by like the amount of beard that you have. You know what I mean? Because it's like, I'm sure that there's another dimension. Yeah. Okay.
So this calculation takes into account, you know, some normal totals that you would think of, the number of Guinness drinkers in the UK, the average amount they consume every year, and then even a breakdown in terms of sips per pint, and then the amount of stash sips per normal, like, down your gullet sip. But my favorite factor is the one that you just referenced, and that the previously cited numbers that I gave you apply to an average mustache surface area, but they further broke it down to different types of facial hair.
Okay.
So the only problem with this is that all of the references, or I guess visual references they gave for this, were British celebrities and personalities, which I recognize some but not others, so I had to do some Googling to kind of find their American equivalents and make this palatable for our, I think, mostly American audience. And then I had to explain to my roommate why she encountered me fervently scrolling through a webpage filled with pictures of Burt Reynolds, but that's beside the point. So
you should never have to account for that.
No explanations. Makes me more mysterious. So, for example, a Teddy Roosevelt walrus-style mustache plus a little bit of Martin Van Buren-esque sideburns will set you back a whopping $36 per year as a beard tax.
I'm going to need an explanation on what the sideburns are doing in this, this particular equation.
It just, I imagine it acting like a sponge where it just sort of, the more facial hair you have, it just kind of wicks
it to the side.
I think we should test, well, you guys, I can't. But you guys should test this empirically in your own experiences.
Check our Instagram.
for updates. Oh, that's going to be so gross. a Burt Reynolds, so more trim but very dense style soup strainer sets you back $16 a year. A more thinned out kind of 5 o'clock shadowy Robert Downey Jr. flavor saver sets you back $12. One of the British examples was this guy named Noel Edmonds, who's a British TV presenter. But actually, the easiest facial hair comparison that I could find for him was all of you guys.
Oh,
so
oh, nice.
Kind of well-trimmed beard mustache combos. So check our Instagram for the visual version of that. So you guys lose a whopping $30 a year.
Wow.
To your facial hair.
So I have one question, which is, what do they think? So the mustache catches the beer, and then why don't I just drink it out of my mustache? It's right there.
I guess you're not trying hard enough. I don't know what to tell you, man.
So
is it really lost is my question.
So something I've experienced is that I feel like every time, like, I get up in the middle of the night and I'm like really dehydrated, so I go get a big cup of water. Like, if I drink a lot of water, half of it is going down my chest. Like, that is happening. And it's a really unpleasant thing. And there's, like, I think about it, most of the time I realize it's happening sort of mid gulp, and I try to adjust, and that just makes everything worse because I'm like breaking the seal. And so I think that it's going out of the mustache, then like down the sides of the mouth.
I think you might have a drinking problem.
I prefer to think of it as a drinking opportunity.
We're only a third way into this episode, and I'm going to say with a fair amount of confidence that is the most dad of the jokes that's going to happen.
This week I learned students' t-test, everyone's favorite statistical hypothesis test, was invented by a chemist working at Guinness in order to monitor the quality of their beer. So, around the year 1900, what was then known as the Arthur Guinness and Son Brewery, which had actually in 1886 become the largest brewery in the world. So, they were huge at this point. They started recruiting scientists, like you mentioned, Rob. Actually, before that, they were actively recruiting scientists to address questions like how to continue producing, you know, gigantic quantities of beer while also maintaining consistency in terms of quality, right? So, William Seeley Gossett, freshly graduated from Oxford, all right, he's got degrees in chemistry, mathematics, he is hot shit, okay? He started working at this brewery.
The idol of our fan club here.
Yeah. So, Gossett begins working at Guinness, and he realizes pretty quickly that meticulous statistical analysis of processes such as barley production and yeast fermentation could profoundly improve the quality control process. However, the existing statistical tests used to estimate averages traditionally had used sample sizes that were way too big to possibly be economical for Guinness. So, Gossett, realizing this, attempts to adapt these tests for small sample sizes, and he found that doing so introduced a whole new source of uncertainty. That is, any variation that's attributable to like random or unknown information, which makes it nearly impossible to distinguish between actual genuine differences between, say, two batches of hops and differences due to this sort of random uncertainty. So Guinness sends Gossett to go study at University College London with the then eminent statistician Carl Pearson, who, you know, the biologists in the room may recognize from the
correlation fame.
Yes, of correlation fame, Pearson's coefficient. And with Pearson, he was able to adapt large sample-based statistical methods to one that could, like, easily analyze and take in small sample sizes, an approach that became known as the t-test. But why do we learn about students' t-test instead of Gossett's t-test? The answer is that Gossett set out to improve Guinness's quality control, and by ensuring that could be done with a smaller sample size, he saved them a lot of money. So naturally, Guinness wanted to keep that information within the company, as control of this technique was a really huge competitive advantage over other breweries. Gossett, on the other hand, ever the scientist, believed that a mathematical breakthrough such as this must be published for the benefit of humanity. History is split on what happened next. Depending on who you ask, either they came to an agreement that Gossett could publish his findings under a pseudonym so that other breweries would be less likely to make the connection to brewing, Or Gossett went all Eppersi Muave Galileo style and published under the pseudonym Student so they wouldn't be able to trace it back to him. Whatever the real story is, Gossett continued to work at Guinness and to publish under the name Student until his death in 1935 and at the age of 61. Now, it's important that Guinness's lawyers understand that I am suggesting that a lifetime of drinking loads of their stout gave him a heart attack. Okay? Not at all. I'm just saying that if it were hypothetically the case, it wouldn't be a bad way to go. Full of delicious foamy Guinness at the end of a statistically significant life.
Ooh, that's nice. That is a good feeling.
So I looked into some other surprising ways that beer has contributed to scientific advancements.
Awesome.
One of them involves Joseph Priestley, the 18th century theologian and chemist who's now mostly remembered as the discoverer of oxygen, but also lesser known for this, developed one of the earliest methods of carbonation and is also the inventor of the soft drink.
Oh,
yeah. Wow.
So he actually was initially inspired to begin his lifetime study of gases after living next door to a brewery in Leeds. And he was specifically intrigued by the layer of fixed air, which is what carbon dioxide was called at the time.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, that hovered above the bubbling vats of beer without mixing with the normal air above it. And he found out that by placing a bowl above these vats, carbon dioxide could be absorbed by the water in the bowl and to a tasty effect. Huh. And in his 1772 paper, impregnating water with fixed air, he laid out the earliest method of carbonation. This technique was later adapted to make carbonated mineral water and expanded to manufacturing and bottling scale by a name that might sound familiar, Johann Jacob Schwepp. And the company he founded around this beverage still exists today.
Wow.
And it's called Schweppes.
Yeah,
there you go. Another story that I found involves someone who is much lesser known, but it's just too great a story not to share. So this involves the work of the 19th century naturalist and polymath Sir John Lubbock. So I guess he kind of is known, though not, I guess, remembered for this, but for coining the terms Paleolithic and Neolithic.
Really?
So we got that from him.
Interesting.
Good job, Sir Lubbock. but he was also a devout student of the biology, life cycle, and social behaviors of ants. So in his book, Ants, Bees, and Wasps, A Record of Observations on the Habits of the Social Hymenoptera, he describes a series of experiments that were designed to determine whether ants identify friends, or their colony mates, essentially, versus strangers, and whether or not they treat those friends or strangers differently depending on this level of familiarity. So the premise of these experiments is interesting, but also a little bit cruel. He would basically have a colony of ants and then drop either colony mates or strangers in among them. And they'd be sort of on this kind of controlled area where there was the main colony, and then there was also this artificial moat of water. And they would see if members of the central colony would either basically pick up the incapacitated friend or stranger that was dropped into the situation and carry them back to the colony, or carry them to the water and drown them. Yeah, nice. Ants are surprisingly merciless.
That's so interesting. So one of my research students right now is doing an ant project, and she's doing something somewhat similar where they take an ant from a colony and then they remove its antenna, and they want to see how it interacts with its colony, if it loses all of its behavioral adaptability, or if it becomes like an outsider, or if it gets confused. But that means that this student of mine has been reading all this ridiculous things that ants do. There's a type of fungus called the cordyceps fungus, mm-hmm. which is worth going into in much more detail.
I really hope we have an episode where that's relevant to discuss.
Because without giving away anything about that fungus, what ants do when one is infected, if other ants detect that it's infected, most of them run away. One ant picks it up and carries it as far as it can until it dies.
Wow.
And basically just gets it out of there. Yeah.
Huh.
It's really, really fascinating. So ants.
Speaking of another relationship between ants and fungus, is I think that people have now generally agreed in the biology field that the earliest example of farming is actually ants living sort of coexisting alongside fungus. That it's like not a pathological fungus that grows inside their hives, and they very clearly maintain it almost exactly like you would imagine like little tiny farmers would. And that I mean is definitely, by all the criteria we could throw at it, is farming and existed tens of thousands of years before our farming did.
So there's one, just to one-up you, uh-huh. in your proto-farming.
That's what we're here for.
Oh, boy.
So there's a type of fungus called a slime mold, which is also a mm-hmm. fascinating living thing that goes through many life cycles and can be multi- and single-cellular at different stages. But a slime mold, incubates bacteria inside of it by making a sugar that is useless to it that bacteria will come and eat, and it'll grow the bacteria like on an agar plate inside of it.
Wow.
So that it can then eat the bacteria later.
That's amazing. Oh man. Okay, so the takeaway from this is that we need to do a fungus episode.
I think that's what we just learned.
But back to the ants momentarily. So I mentioned that part of these experiments involved incapacitating some ants and then seeing what either happy happenstance or tragic happenstance befell them. And some of the methods that he used to incapacitate them included actually already kind of semi-drowning them, also treating them with chloroform. And he realized that in these cases, the ants appeared questionably dead, and that might confound their peers' responses. As a sort of middle ground to still incapacitate the ants while giving them the appearance not of being dead, but just in needing of a little assistance, he actually got them drunk off of beer.
Nice.
And this experiment worked pretty well. The results were that the sober colony ants recognized their wasted friends and carried them home to the colony.
Oh, that's sweet.
Right? Oh, they're just like us. That's so cute.
They're just like us, Emily.
But until you consider that they tossed the drunk strangers to the curb, and by the curb, I mean in the water, to drown to death. So,
oh my God.
On second thought,
they're just like us.
This week I learned that the Guinness Book of World Records came to be after Sir Hugh Beaver, the manager of Guinness, got into an argument about the flying speed of the golden plover.
Hugh Beaver is a hell of a name.
Oh, just you wait. There are some phenomenal names that get tossed around in this fact. So before I go into it further, though, I have a little straw poll for you guys, if you'll humor me. In all the times that you've been to the pub, grabbed a beer or two, and shot the S word with some friends, have you ever found yourselves sucked into a heated debate about the identity of the fastest game bird in Europe?
Only every single time I've recounted line by line Monty Python's Search for the Holy Grail. Was it a European Fair. Golden plover or an African golden plover?
It was a European.
Oh, well, that settles that.
I never have. I've never been encountering such a thing. I don't go to the right bars.
Or maybe you do. But fair enough. So the Guinness Book of World Records was created to address that exact concern, that trivial arguments were brewing discontent and inciting outbreaks of factual fisticuffs and thwarting the harmonious consumption of Guinness in pubs all over the world.
Now, there's a great trivia name. Factual fisticuffs.
Oh, that's amazing.
That's a great team name.
Dibs.
Damn it. So, our story starts, as the best ones on this podcast do, with a series of, as I mentioned before, ridiculous names. So we have Sir Hugh Beaver, the managing director of Guinness Breweries, and he went out shooting with some friends one afternoon in 1951 in North Slob.
North Slob.
I know, I love it.
Where is that?
It's in Ireland.
Oh.
Okay.
Carry on.
So he was out with his buds and he missed a shot at a golden plover and, likely trying to excuse the fact that he totally whiffed it, insisted that it was the fastest game bird in Europe, while his companions insisted that that title actually belonged to the red grouse. So, fun fact, just to, you know, get rid of all the suspense that I'm sure everyone is suffering right now, the golden plover is actually the faster of the two. So he got lucky that time.
I knew it, Rob.
But it was also in that moment that he realized that he was facing a very specific dilemma that maybe other people were also facing. And thus the idea of the Guinness Book was born. So whether that assessment, in terms of people having these arguments and destroying friendships over which bird flies faster, was founded or not, I do believe that he was at least a little ahead of his time. Honestly, I could totally see it being pitched nowadays in Silicon Valley as Uber, but for facts.
Ubered.
There we go. So while Sir Beaver provided the idea and the funding for the Guinness Book,
I just can't get over Sir Beaver. I'm sorry.
Sorry, I have another.
It's like the wind in the willows.
Should we substitute
his name? Sir Beaver is coming.
So while Sir Beaver provided the idea and the funding for the Guinness Book, the compilation of records and actual writing of the book fell to twins Norris and Ross McWhirter, appropriately tapped because they actually ran a fact-finding agency in London at the time.
Oh, cool.
Which is not a thing that I knew existed, but essentially their job was compiling...
Do this podcast.
Well, exactly. I was like, what? Why are we one of those? But their job was compiling facts to dole out to various outlets, especially for sports. So these guys were also pretty remarkable. They are both reported to have had encyclopedic and photographic memories, which they showed off on the television series Record Breakers, which involved them answering audience questions about literally any entry in the Guinness books to date, and they would give detailed, accurate answers just on the spot.
So could pretty they amazing. Remember more words or more pictures? Because a picture's worth 1,000 words.
If we were to quantify just how good their memory was, I guess that's how you do it. Fair enough. And upon the opening of Guinness Superlatives Incorporated, their offices on Fleet Street in 1954, the brothers set to work writing the first edition of the book. And they worked really late, or I dare say super late, on those superlatives. So dumb, but I can't help myself. And actually spent 13 and a half 90-hour weeks gathering all the facts and receiving submissions for new records and then contacting the appropriate sources and experts to verify whether those new records could actually be feasible and debunking them if they weren't. The first book itself was 200 pages long and had 4,000 records, which is actually still the number of records per book to this day. And just to give you a little bit of a taste of what the first set of records included, John R. Cobb, who was then the holder of the world land speed record at 403 miles per hour in his custom-designed Napier Railton race car.
Wow.
It's actually pretty fast when you, like, you know, when you think about it, especially for then.
What time?
1954.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know. I was impressed. Manningford Faith Yawn Graceful, the cow with the highest lifetime milk yield.
What?
Yeah, hey, why not? And
oh, cow.
What did you hear?
I thought count.
Von beautiful milk yield.
Oh my God. Don't stop.
1 gallon. Two gallon.
I sincerely thought that whole long name was some, like, German count. And then you said milk yield.
It was just a very distinguished cow. She earned all those titles, you know.
Yeah.
Another entry that I thought was kind of entertaining was the Smith's Arms, which was, at the time, the smallest pub in Britain and measured 10 feet wide and 4 feet high. It's since closed, but I was kind of Googling it anyways, and it had an interesting legend associated with it, which was that it got its liquor license because one day King Charles II swung by the town and was like, hey, someone give me a beer. And they're like, we don't have a license for that. And he was like, well, now you do. Kinged.
Nice.
So Norris and Ross served as the main writers and editors of the Guinness Book for most of their lives, with Norris staying on the staff for the most part as a writer and then later as a consultant for a little over 50 years. It was pretty impressive.
Wow.
And that first edition of the book, which was released in 1955, was also a top seller in Britain, and its launch in the U.S. a year later was really successful as well. And since then, it's gone over to sell over 100 million copies in 100 different countries and in 37 languages, making it, satisfyingly, the Guinness World Record holder for best-selling copyrighted book in history.
Wow.
So the book has its own record.
So since our main fact is about sort of just Guinness beer in general, I thought I would point out a couple sort of liquid consumption records. One is that the official fastest time to drink a bottle of ketchup was 17.53 seconds and was achieved by André Ortolf from Germany, and I was in Augsburg in 2017. Then the fastest time to drink half a liter of water was 1.75 seconds.
Wow.
Achieved in 2014. Well, you say wow.
Half a liter.
Half a liter. Okay, but the official Guinness Book of World Records fastest time to drink 1 liter of beer is 1.3 seconds.
Oh,
what?
That's less than the world record for half as much water.
And that's, I assume, unassisted, like without like a funnel.
Yeah, it was just a like a liter in a jug.
Oh, God.
The beer record was set in 1977 in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, and that actually was a 56% improvement over the previous world record set several years earlier by Peter Dowdswell of England. That was 2.3 seconds for 1 liter. So the record holder for half a liter of water is not even close to that. I mean, you know, propagating by volume, like, that's nothing. We should get on that.
Ooh, the water I'll half leader is wide open.
I just
open.
Feel like the water half liter record is just begging to be broken.
So I had a roommate back in college who would come home every night after drinking and then take a regular Poland Spring bottle of water, and he would grab the top and the bottom of the bottle and then twist it in opposite directions, and he could drink it in a second.
Wow.
And I thought it was, as a 19-year-old, the most impressive thing in the world.
Had you seen a girl yet?
Things were different back then, all right? Like, I just...
simpler times.
But I just remember he did it, and he threw the crushed bottle on the ground, and he said, instant hydration.
All right, guys, we've arrived at the quiz, the proverbial pot of gold at the end of our trivia rainbow.
Ooh,
nice. Now, you guys might have noticed that while I talked about the origin of the Guinness World Records in my fact, I didn't divulge any anecdotes about the records themselves. That's because I'm going to ask you about an assortment of some standout Guinness World Records and record attempts in this week's quiz.
Oh, boy.
Okay. All right, so get your lucky charms. You're going to need them.
Okay.
I don't know how I feel about that. We're going to scrap that line.
I don't have any milk.
Call the count.
All right. So let's see if we can break some fax machine records.
All right.
This quiz. All right. So question one. The world record for the most of these, which were invented accidentally by a chemist at 3M, stuck to a human face in 1 minute, is 58. What are these?
I think it's Post-it notes.
Oh, Post-it notes, yeah.
Yeah, although they were actually invented by Romy and Michelle. Who? I just want to point that out. If anybody. Yeah, what? Okay.
What?
Is there an age divide that just became apparent?
Okay. Yeah, sorry.
You should be sorry. Okay, so the answer is Post-it notes.
Yes, the answer is Post-it notes. And I should mention that I found this on a list called 17 World Records that you could break tomorrow. So to our listeners, if any coworkers swing by your cubicle tomorrow to ask why your face is papered in Post-it notes, be sure to refer them to Fax Machine.
What was the number?
58.
58.
That is so doable.
It really is. And the only rules are they must be normal dimensions, so like, you know, normal square Post-it notes, placed by the owner of the face, attached for at least 10 seconds after the minute is over, and not on the owner's eyelids, which I assume is only for safety reasons, but anyways, so I don't know. I think it's doable.
Yeah. Let's get on it.
All right.
Yeah, I like it.
To do. Question two. Kane Tanaka, announced by Guinness on March 9th, 2019, as the world's current oldest person, was born the same year as the Wright brothers' first flight. How old is she?
Wright brothers' first flight was 1905.
I thought it was 7.
Okay, 1907-ish.
So 112, 111 or 112?
Something like that.
Sounds too young.
I would have thought it would be like, well, it could be 112. Let's go with that. 112.
I want to give it to you because you guys were very close. So she's 116.
Okay.
The flight was December 17th, 1903. But
okay, so we overshot slightly. Yeah. But we, you know, had the right decade.
1903.
I feel okay with that.
Yeah. The oldest person to have ever lived was Jean-Louise Calment, who was born in 1875 and died in 1997 at a whopping 122 years old.
Wow.
Crazy.
I think that she was the one who was like obsessed with like olive oil. And I think she was obsessed with olive oil and like claimed that she like rubbed it all over her body and that's what was like responsible for her longevity. And I think this is the person where the quote is, she said, I only have one crease on my entire body and I'm sitting on it.
That is baller.
I'm pretty sure that was her. I know a lot more about her than I thought.
Yeah.
Yes.
Now that I'm talking about
it. It's just all getting pulled out of the air. All right. So question three. Who was recently awarded the Guinness World Record for longest career as a live-action Marvel superhero? There are two correct answers.
So the question is the actor or the character?
The actors.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Assuming it's a pair, it would be Sir Patrick Stewart and Ian McClellan.
And neither of them are dead.
Almost. You got half of it right.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Are okay. they? Is it? Are,
no, no. Neither of them are dead.
No, they're. Oh my God.
They go out in the city all the time.
Oh my God.
Same reaction. Give like,
me a heart attack.
Don't do that to me. So,
this one's not about dying.
Please.
Right. Oh my God. That was the last question. Okay, thank God. Okay. So this question is just about they were the longest
superheroes.
Yes.
longest superheroes. Just like
it's Elastigirl.
Real song.
Yeah, Elastigirl. So you say Patrick Stewart is one of them?
So then Hugh Jackman?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Because they were both in Logan.
Exactly. So it was Wolverine and Professor X, Hugh Jackman and Patrick Stewart, respectively, in the X-Men films, of course. They've both performed these roles for over 16 years, starting with X-Men in 2000 and most recently in Logan in 2017.
Wow.
And actually, I was reading an article about this. Hugh Jackman has a history of attempting to win Guinness World Records. Huh. As a kid, he and his brother attempted to break the records for most coins snatched off one's elbow and longest badminton game. Question four. In 2004, the NYC restaurant Serendipity 3 released their most expensive dessert, and now the record holder for the world's most expensive dessert, the Golden Opulence Sundae. How much does it cost? I'll accept within a $50 window.
I think it's a $1,000 milkshake.
Okay.
Or a $1,000 sundae.
I will defer to you.
Yeah, because I can't imagine it's a $10,000 sundae. So I think it's a $1,000.
That's correct.
Yeah.
It's $1,000?
$1,000.
Yeah, it's $1,000.
Damn. Yep.
You have to order it 24 hours in advance. Oh. So I should say two things quickly. One is that Serendipity 3 is like six blocks from here. And two, for the listeners that don't know this, I won a bet last year where I get free milkshakes for a year.
Oh, no.
And I was really intent on getting this.
This is great. Actually, so like Rob and I went to IHOP after trivia one night, just like at 2 a.m. And Rob orders two milkshakes and then is just taking pictures of them. And then we're like, Rob, why are you doing this? And he's like, well, I want to bet where I get free milkshakes. And if I document the milkshake and send it to someone, they just send me the amount that the milkshake cost. And he was like, I'm really pushing the boundaries here by sending two. And then I think she did actually send you double milkshake. This is a great bet.
It's a binding bet. She had no idea how much I liked milkshakes when we made this bet.
Well, I'm sure you liked them after. Well, the best part
of this bet is that what were the stakes of the bet?
Oh, so if I won, I got free milkshakes for a year. And if she won, she got the sweatshirt that I'm wearing right now.
It's the stupidest bet. I mean, it's a really nice sweatshirt, Rob.
Yeah, it is my favorite sweatshirt, hands down. I value it at the cost of a year's worth of milkshakes.
But I mean, would she? That's the question.
No, not at all.
Yeah, that's not an even deal.
What was the bet on?
It was on fantasy football.
Okay.
Yeah. Like a
so
random,
it was worth it.
Totally worth it.
Okay. All right. So that's how Rob knows a lot about ice cream. He's been scoping out the $1,000 sundae.
Yeah. So watch out.
Question five. A few weeks ago in Mesa, Arizona, hundreds of people attempted to break the world record for largest yoga class featuring what even-toed ungulate?
Llama. Or goats.
Even-toed?
Because there's goat yoga.
Wait, really?
Yeah. That's like a big thing. Is it goat yoga?
Yeah, you got it. Wow. I wasn't sure if you guys had heard of it.
Goat yoga is cool. I mean, I've never done it, but I like watching videos of goats. Really
like
doing anything.
If I've ever heard of it, I thought it was goat yogurt.
Which is also a thing.
Sounds very legit.
There's goat milk. I guess there's goat yogurt. So I saw this in an article whose title starts with, Ba-ma-ste.
Damn.
The record involved 351 human participants and 84 goat participants. And the yoga instructor Sarah Williams has actually had prior experience in this arena, having broken the Guinness World Record for the fastest time to climb over a human tunnel by a goat in 2017.
So much in that.
Yep. So they'll find out in May if they broke this record as well.
Oh, you know what's great is that if they get the record, then they're also the greatest of all time.
Yes!
Next question!
All right. Question six. Despite this having over 3 billion combinations, but only one solution, in quotes, the record for solving one is somehow 3.73 seconds. What is this?
Rubik's Cube.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Very nice. So the speed cuber Nathaniel Berg of Sweden is the proud owner of this record as of the 2015 Danish Open Championships. And in case you guys are interested in setting a Rubik's Cube related record, which if anyone would be interested, it's probably you guys. I gotta warn you.
You say that, but in a way that makes me think you're not complimenting us.
Leave it up to interpretation. I gotta warn you, though, that the playing field is pretty crowded. There are world record holders for the following Rubik's Cube associated feats. Most Rubik's Cubes solved in a bicycle. It's 1,010. Most Rubik's Cubes solved underwater while holding your breath.
Yeah, the underwater one I've seen videos of. It's really, really, really cool.
That's
yeah.
nuts. Largest Rubik's Cube solved by a robot, 9x9. We're doomed.
That's incredible.
Fewest moves to solve a Rubik's Cube, 19. And it's not by the same guy that solved one in 3.73 seconds. So how that works, I don't know. And the fastest time to solve a Rubik's Cube while juggling, which is 22.25 seconds.
And it wasn't this, I don't know if it's that record, but I know that this kid set some record by, I think he solved 3 Rubik's Cubes while he was juggling them. And so like every time it comes down into his hand, he like turns one and he's like watching it. And the most incredible, like heart-stopping moment was he, at some point while he's juggling all 3 of these, 2 of them hit each other in midair. And then he catches them and goes back to it and actually finishes it out and like breaks the record or something. It was
because there's also the clock in the background counting down, and the entire audience is like, oh no. And there's like an entire cube that's not done yet, and there's only like 12 seconds left.
And then like when the cubes hit each other in midair, like the audience just screeched. They were like, no. But then he saved it and everybody just lost their minds. It was great.
Wow. Question 7. What primetime television celeb holds the Guinness World Record for most frequent clapper?
It's over one's entire life. So it must be like on TV, like has clapped the most over their career on television.
Right. Yeah. So that's true. It's recorded.
So primetime, though. So like it's not a late night show. It's not like a Jimmy Kimmel or somebody.
No.
I mean, is it somebody on like a show like American Idol or one of those like talent shows?
It is. It's a game show.
Oh.
Oh, it's Vanna White.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Exactly. From the Wheel
absolutely.
Of Fortune.
Yes.
What,
that exact wheel, yes. So it's estimated that she's clapped at least 3,480,864 times across the show's 30 seasons. That's an average of 606 claps per show as of her record break in 2013.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
That's wild.
Yeah, her arms must be so toned. Oh, my God. All right, question 8, our last question. The 2019 edition of the Guinness World Records features Barry John Crowe of Cavan, Ireland, a butcher who recently earned the title of most sausages produced in a minute. How many sausages did he roll to break the record? I'll take a margin of 5.
Oh, man.
Sausages rolled in a minute.
Yeah.
What goes into rolling a sausage?
Yeah. How, I mean, what do you think per second? Could you roll a sausage in a second?
That's, I have no idea. I don't know how they get in the roll.
No idea what that even means. Like, how big are these sausages?
Oh, really?
In my head.
Is it a standard sausage roll?
In my head, it's like the ticket machine at a deli, and the guy's just running with it, like pulling hundreds out per second.
So you take the actual ground meat for the sausage and fill it into like the natural casing, right, the intestine, and then it's just one long intestine filled with sausage. I actually, like, when I was a small child, used to make sausages in my bowl. That's why I don't get squeamish. And then you take that long, continuous intestine full of meat and twist it off in, like, little links to separate it. So
what he's doing is the twisting.
Exactly.
So it's how many twists.
Can there be mechanical assist pulling the intestinal sausage chain?
My understanding is that he just had the long, continuous, single sausage.
Meat tube.
And then, and then made a bunch of smaller ones.
This makes me think, like, 2 per second.
Okay. I'm cool with that. 120? She said within 5. 125?
Why would that change your answer?
It wouldn't. I'm just scared because we're not going to get it. Let's go 120.
What, 120?
Wait, do you think it could be more?
I don't know.
Should we what was his name again? What was his name again?
His name.
I'm just trying to count it a second.
No,
really
just
quick.
His name is Barry John Crowe.
All right, should we bet on Barry?
Yeah, because now that I'm thinking about it, a second is a really long time, and you can make that twisting motion super fast.
Let's say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, let's say 5 a second.
That was more than a second.
Oh, okay, let's say 3.5 a second.
You know how long a second is, right?
Yeah, it's, 1/1,000. I think, well, Anthony is counting out seconds with his hands, and every single time I can go, all right, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I can do 5. I can do 5 in a second. I think I could break this record, guys. Oh my God. Okay,
well, we don't know what it is.
Definitely
yet.
300 seconds, 300 rolls.
Is that your final answer?
I don't think so, that you've responded like that. Yes.
I'm feeling closer to 2, but I'm good with 300 as a guess.
Okay, you want to average that?
250?
Okay.
Yeah. 250. Final answer.
Okay, you are both stunningly wrong. It's like the answer seven. Is actually 78, aww, which is faster than a sausage a second. I still think that's quite impressive. 250 is, I don't think, humanly feasible. But
I think we worked our way. We started at like the very barrier of logic, and we just kept charging in the wrong direction.
You're going down, Barry. That's all I'm saying. If you could only do just over 1 a second,
poor Barry.
I'm going to crush you.
He's a sweet man.
How do you know?
Reading the article, like he's just a very cheerful, grateful person. Okay. And also from this quote, which I'd like to end on, which I think kind of sums up the quiz and the episode well. I'd love to just say to people, go for it. If you feel that you can do a Guinness World Record title, go for it.
Okay.
It's just so sweet.
I'm good. I'm coming for your record, Barry. Enjoy your 15
Barry,
minutes of fame.
I'm so sorry, Barry.
Run, Barry, run.
My intent. All right, guys, thanks for listening. If you want to check out some more content from us, you can see our social media accounts. We're on Facebook at Fax Machine Podcast and also on Instagram and Twitter at Fax Machine Pod. And you can find me on Instagram and Twitter at @MCosta, Rob.
At Whiteboard Rob.
And Noah.
At Arcs and Sciences.
And producer Anthony at The Cosmic ACA. Fax Machine is hosted and written by me, Emily Costa, Rob Frawley, and Noah Guyberson. It's produced by Anthony Antonelli, and our logo was designed by Mike Zola. And we implore you, if you guys like what you heard, maybe tell a friend about us. That'd be really nice. We also do have an upcoming live show, so stay tuned for more details about that. That's all for now. Thanks for tuning in. Bye.
Bye.
For the average mustachioed Guinness drinker.
The mustachioed Guinness drinker?
For,
is that what it was?
Yeah. So the average mustachioed Guinness drinker. One more time. The average mustachioed Guinness drinker.
Nope.
No. That was worse. Yeah. Okay.